FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome, and you are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz. It's September 25th, 2018. Well, we talk a lot about the screwed up medical system, the excessive cost involved, the inability of you to get treatment, so many other things that are messed up about our system. And we're going to talk a lot more about it. But first, as always, be a part of the show. We invite you to join the dialogue. I've got Dr. Elena George's medical hack list that has personally saved me tens of thousands of dollars over the past 4 years. Just email us, kl@kerrylutz.com. We will send it out and you can start saving right away. Well, so the system is screwed up. Government is the reason it's screwed up. Not necessarily just Obamacare. It goes way, way back. And we're really thrilled to have on with us now Sean Flynn. Sean, you're running for Congress. We don't usually deal with politicians or wannabe politicians on the show, but your message is so poignant. Look, your background kind of sums it up. You're an economist, author. You wrote Economics for Dummies, and you took on the Obama administration when you were selling default insurance on student loans, and of course lost, and so many other things that you've done. So we're really thrilled to have you on the show. Welcome.
Oh, Kerry, thank you. It's an honor to be here. I'm really looking forward to this chat.
Hey, so you're with your background, okay, and being a professor, college professor, you've developed a passion for the subject of healthcare and the economics of healthcare. And really, the two in America today are inseparable. We can both agree that the system is broken and needs a major overhaul. How did it get this way?
Well, it's interesting. The historical story here starts back in World War II, believe it or not. And, you know, where it leads is that we're the only country in the world where people to get, you know, health insurance and healthcare coverage is tied to employment. This is true in no other country in the world. And the problem from an economic standpoint is once you have employer-provided health insurance, individuals lose track of costs, they stop being comparison shoppers, and then all the big special interests in healthcare can start taking advantage of the system and overcharging behind the scenes because there's this third-party billing system where individuals don't even know the price tags or what's going on. And it started in World War II with price controls because the government was afraid of a giant inflation stateside because Rosie the Riveter and millions of people were working hard in factories 24 hours a day and getting paid cash. But at the same time, when they went shopping at stores, there was almost nothing to buy because we basically stopped producing consumer goods for 4 years in order to direct all the production of the factories towards either making armaments or clothes for soldiers and stuff like that. So they were afraid that Rosie the Riveter and people stateside would go into stores, there'd be almost nothing to buy, and then just on demand and supply, a lot of cash chasing very few consumer goods, prices would skyrocket. So they slapped wage and price controls over the entire economy. And it meant literally no one could change a price without approval from a bureaucrat in Washington, even price of bubble gum. And what that led to very quickly was a situation where employers who needed labor could no longer bid for labor. And one of those employers was Henry Kaiser, the founder of Kaiser Steel, Kaiser Aluminum, Kaiser Shipbuilding, and as I'm about to tell you, what eventually became Kaiser Permanente, the big chain of HMOs across the country. He needed to build Liberty boats. He had an order for something like 10,000 Liberty boats, transportation boats for the war, for World War II, and his shipbuilding facilities were on the West Coast in places like Long Beach, California, and there was one in the Bay Area south of Oakland. And he needed labor, and he couldn't get enough labor because he couldn't bid wages higher, right? Because most industrial workers at that time were in the Midwest around Detroit and places like that. And so since he was not legally allowed to give people higher wages to attract them to move out west, he accidentally stumbled upon giving them free health care because perks, benefits, fringe benefits were not subject to the wage and price controls. And so he started giving free health care away. Then back east in Detroit, where they wanted to keep fewer of their workers from moving out west to work for Kaiser, the big companies there, Ford, General Motors, they started offering free health insurance. And this thing kind of snowballed. And then after World War II, it stuck because Congress changed the tax code such that if an employer pays for your health insurance, they get to deduct it. But if the employer instead gave you the money, it would become taxable income and you'd have to pay taxes on it first before you could go buy your insurance premium. And so for both the employees as well as the employer, it makes more sense financially because of this difference in the tax code, differential treatment for people to get their insurance through the employer. So we accidentally started the system with the World War II wage and price controls, and then we locked it in I think 1952 or 54 by changing our tax code to bias everything towards employer payments for insurance. And ever since then, and then, you know, then the government got involved in big ways in 1965 with Medicare and Medicaid, you know, the giant federal state health insurance programs, which also put a lot of people on insurance who didn't have it before. And again, you have this problem where if someone else is paying the insurance premium, and in certain cases also the deductibles and copays, people stop being price sensitive. They stop looking around for, you know, a good deal. They think healthcare is free. Yeah. It leads to so many problems just because people no longer have any sense of costs.
So effectively, if I can just summarize what you're saying, this pretty much is a case of the law of unintended consequences and what happens when government interferes in markets that they shouldn't. Now, granted, their motivation for wage and price controls, I'm sure, had the best interest of the country at heart, but they never stopped to think of dislocations and irrational effects in the marketplace once they started monkeying with it.
Well, yes, if anything, if someone with sort of the central planner mind sees an unintended consequence, their reaction isn't to say, hey, we goofed up. Let's go back to the, you know, the status quo ante, how things were before. Their reaction is to say, well, let's meddle some more. And so the thing is really snowballed over time. It's not just that initial error. It's gotten worse and worse and worse.
Mm-hmm. So it's a case of one error being compounded many, many times over. So the concept of insurance is great, but then when you have no interest in the outcome other than you want to be treated, then you become a less savvy, less educated medical services consumer, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, the typical way things work, if you have health insurance in America, like I've got Blue Cross Blue Shield through my employer, is I go into my doctor, I ask her to do something. She does it. She does a good job. And then 3 months later, I get this mysterious bill with crazy numbers. And then there's a line down at the bottom that says something like, this is your share, or you pay this amount,
copay,
which is some fraction of the crazy total. And what goes on in the meantime is that, you know, she sees me, she submits billing codes to the insurance company. The insurance company, almost like a ritual, will deny or claim there's something wrong. And then basically someone representing the doctor or medical group and then someone representing the insurance company get into like a 3 month battle over how much will actually be paid. And that's where so much of the waste is in our system, is because we're essentially using a barter system behind the scenes because there's no upfront price tags, right? Price tags are take it or leave it pricing. They really reduce search costs and frictions. They make comparison shopping easy. But if you don't have them, then someone has to do a barter negotiation behind the scenes. And that just takes up a huge amount of time and resources, and it just causes massive amounts of waste. And then beyond that, since I don't see the full bill and never do till 3 months later, I have no incentive to comparison shop. That doctor herself doesn't have a lot of incentive, or her medical group, to compete with other doctors to lower prices because all the prices are hidden.
That's right. So there's no transparency as to pricing. And honestly, a lot of people, if they're not paying, they don't care about the price anyway. And if they're paying such a small piece of it, they don't really care. So it's $10 more than it should have been, right? So you divorce the consumer from the economic realities of her decision, and then you wind up with a mess like this. But what about the concept of Medicare and Medicaid? All right, let's assume that it shouldn't exist. What should exist in lieu of these programs?
Well, you know, there's an amazing way to fix them that the state of Indiana actually did, and it's been in place since 2011. It's very similar to something Whole Foods Markets implemented in the private sector starting in 2002. And what it is you create a version of Medicaid, you know, which is the joint federal state health insurance program for people of lower incomes. They created an alternative version in Indiana. They called it the Healthy Indiana Program. People can look it up online, Healthy Indiana Program. And what they did was they created a version of Medicaid in which people do have skin in the game and a reason to shop around and a reason not to waste money. And so normal Medicaid, by comparison, is what an economist or an insurance guy would call first dollar coverage, meaning everything is paid for by the government. They pay for the first dollar, the second dollar, the third dollar, all the way up to infinity. And in a system like that, the patient has no sense of costs and therefore no reason to be cautious about costs or spending or making good decisions. So what they did in Indiana was they wanted to give people skin in the game, and they set up a version, an alternative version of Medicaid, where there is an $1,100 per year deductible. Now, your first reaction to this should be, oh my goodness, these are working poor or maybe unemployed people. How will they ever cover an $1,100 a year deductible? And the answer is they probably can't. And so the state of Indiana, knowing that, just created health savings accounts and gifted people the amount of the annual deductible. They were gifted $1,100. But then they were also told, hey, every year you're in the program, you'll get another $1,100, but we're going to make a deal with you. Any money you don't spend in any year is yours to keep. It rolls over in your health savings account to the next year. So suddenly now people have a reason to shop around, to conserve. You've given them skin in the game. And what's really amazing about this, Kerry, is that it's a net cost saver, because what happens is once people have skin in the game, believe it or not, and this happened both with the Whole Foods employees, it happened in the state of Indiana example I'm telling you about, the total amount of savings in the back end fell 35%. It fell so dramatically that it more than pays for those annual gifts of giving people the amount of the annual deductible, right? Which makes them feel financially secure. So there's a 12% net cost savings.
So if you're a Democrat, this program was a major failure because all these people aren't getting health care that they would otherwise, just if they have an itch in their throat, they go to the doctor. You know, so all these people are being deprived of health care. That's always the left's rationalization why health care savings accounts are bad.
That's right. And it doesn't have to be that way. So this is the trick here. And, you know, I've spent a lot of years trying to tell people about this trick and that there's so many examples in the private sector and the government sector of it working. Is you simply gift people the amount of the annual deductible. And Whole Foods, being a private company, does it for its workers. The numbers are a little different. The annual deductible is, I think, $1,850 a year, but they just gift them $1,850 a year and tell them any money you don't spend is yours to keep. It rolls over. And that gives people an incentive to shop around and, you know, not waste money, always go for the best deal. You don't take your kid in every time it has the sniffles to the emergency room. And all of a sudden, you've got 12% net cost savings compared to PPOs and HMOs. So even if someone's only concern right now is increasing the number of Americans who have some form of health insurance, well, this thing saves 12%. You could massively increase Medicaid, for instance. Okay. Right? This is, there's no reason for anyone on either the left or the right or the middle or, you know, sensible libertarians like yourself to object to any of this. It's a win-win-win just by giving people skin in the game.
Well, I wonder how the numbers vary if you increase it from 1,100 to 2,000. It seems like the more incentive you give, the more judicious people are going to be with their little jackpot there.
Well, I think so. And, you know, what you find, speaking of jackpot, not just that incentive effect getting bigger with the larger size of the pile, which I think is probably, you know, we haven't run the experiment, obviously, so I can't give you a guarantee there. But yeah, my instinct is where yours is. But people also many people who are on these programs, it's the first time in their life they've accumulated any wealth, because, you know, most people don't have catastrophic years. They are pretty healthy. They spend much less than they were given in their health savings account. It piles up, it rolls over the next year. So what you also find is that people get a real sense of investment in America and their communities and building wealth. And that transfers over to other behaviors in their life. It changes perspective dramatically, I think, in the best possible way.
Hey, and that's really just, it's kind of Freakonomics economics, right? It's behavioral economics at its best.
Yes, it is. It is, right? And, you know, some people's first reaction to this, because they're thinking purely rationally, is, well, if you just give them $1,100 a year, they're just going to blow through all the money. Well, it turns out they don't. And this is where the behavioral economics comes in. There's something that got the Nobel Prize called loss aversion. And, you know, people hold on to what they have and they spend what they have much better than they do other people's money. And this is hardwired into us. Their experiments in monkeys and other animals show that they also show this behavior. It's like that old proverb, one in the hand is worth two in the bush. And so people will, you know, once you give them something, they'll treat it like, oh, my goodness, this is precious. It's a resource. It now belongs to me. I'm going to be really careful with it. And so they actually do not become profligate with the money you gift them in the health savings accounts. Just the opposite happens. And it's, yeah, actually what you said exactly, one of these Freakonomics, behavioral economics things.
Hey, and what about medical providers? Did they, I hate the concept of calling them providers. I think it's so condescending and demeaning. I think people in the medical profession are more than just providers. But do they like give incentives to people who've got this so that they'll take less of a copay or whatever? What do they do there? What's the profession's reaction to this policy?
Well, so I'm going to say something very paradoxical here, which is their reaction is almost nothing. But the reason for that is so few people are on these plans that it's like a rounding error, right? So one way to think about this, like the state of Indiana, in addition to what I told you about this variation on Medicaid called the Healthy Indiana Program, they earlier, back in 2007, implemented the same thing, but with state government employees. So there was the annual, you know, benefits fair in November where people get to choose their health insurance plan. They were given options, PPOs, HMOs, this and that. And then they were given something like what I just told you. There's an insurance with deductibles, and then you gift them the amount of the annual deductibles. Well, those people, they showed this dramatic decrease in spending, right? 35% was also the number they got. But here's the trick. That was almost entirely reductions in usage and wasteful usage, right? People used to be taking a lot of brand name drugs instead of generics. And they would do that when they were on a PPO or an HMO because someone else was footing the bill. All of a sudden, when they have an annual deductible and some money that they get to roll over if they don't spend it, suddenly they're almost all using generic drugs, right? So, which are chemically equivalent, the healthcare ends up being the same, but they're not wasting money anymore. And so you see these dramatic changes in behavior, and that 35% really comes, and this is to answer your question here, where does the savings come from? It really is just reductions in wasteful usage. The providers, though, and, you know, I looked into this, only 1% of state employees, or I'm sorry, only 1% of people with jobs in the state of Indiana work for the state government, right? So at most, 1% of the population of workers is going to be cutting back on their healthcare spending 35%. Well, 1% cutting back 35%, that's, you know, a third of a percent of the total amount of healthcare spending.
Right.
It's a blip in terms of a market demand curve. It's not even there. Like Walmart would not notice.
Yeah, it's a rounding error.
Of its customers. Yeah, it's a rounding error. So what you need here to have an even bigger secondary effect, though, is imagine you put everyone in the state of Indiana on this plan. Everyone in the state of Indiana cuts back 35% on the wasteful spending. That would be something the providers, as you're saying, would have to notice, right? Because if Walmart suddenly lost 35% of its revenue because every customer cut back 35%, well, they would actually have to start being productive, cutting prices, putting things on sale. But what's amazing is that 35% reduction comes solely from quantity reductions, not price reductions. But if you also had the entire market demand curve shifting to the left there, because everyone's cutting back by 35%, mm-hmm. then you'd also see a drop in equilibrium market prices. So you get benefits both from reductions in wasteful quantity, as well as benefits and reductions from prices. And the two together, you're looking at maybe a 70% net cost savings. I mean, the numbers involved are just baffling when you calculate them.
So there's obviously a lot of other issues besides the way that we pay for medical care, the creeping over credentialization, if that's a word.
Sure.
Where, you know, certain states have fought against it, fought back against it. But basically, you know, you need a doctorate degree to take somebody's temperature. You know, you need to you need to be, you know, doctor in front of your name before you can prescribe a drug. Maybe that's for the better, but basic little nonsensical functions. And if we look at what happens like in dentistry, where most people don't have insurance, the situation's a lot different there, isn't it?
That's right. And, you know, veterinary, till recently, there was no insurance. And then we also need to keep in mind the parts of the, I call it the regular medical system, where insurance doesn't cover things, right? Things that are elective procedures,
plastic
like
surgery.
Cosmetic surgery, LASIK eye surgery. If you look at those parts of our healthcare system, which are basically cash and carry, since there's no insurance accepted, mm-hmm. They have shown sustained, almost continual downward prices, you know, more efficiency and higher quality. And you probably know the best example is LASIK. LASIK eye surgery back in the 90s, we're talking upwards of $5,000 an eyeball.
Correct.
It's now $500 an eyeball with a Groupon.
Yeah.
Right. And so this is the reason that the Groupon part's really important is because that shows that doctors there, when they don't have insurance, when they actually have to be business people, well, they're doing sales, they're doing marketing, they have to make sure referrals and word of mouth are good. That's not true of the person who does your heart stents. That's not true of someone putting in hip replacements. That's not true of someone treating your pink eye, because all those things are covered by insurance. And there's no competitive pressure there for doctors to either raise quality or lower prices.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And it's, you know, you got like drive up LASIKs now. So it's.
Yes, this is true. Yeah.
So the market will work when it's given a chance to. However, we do still have the demographic trend. You're getting older. I'm getting older. Older people need more health care as a rule, or more sick care. It's not really health care. So at some point, the demand is going up. And even if you implement all these efficiencies, which are proven to work and are effective, you're still going to get to the point where demand is just increasing more than supply.
Absolutely, though. But the artificial increases in demand caused by third-party billing and insurance are vastly larger than, you know, the sort of demographic bubble you're talking about. If we just implemented price tags and the sort of insurance I was discussing earlier, that would probably cut healthcare costs 70-75%. And the reason I know that is one other country in the world has done both of those policies, and they're spending half as much as Canada and England. They're spending 75% less than we are. And it's just simple things like putting a little free markets in competition. And they've also gotten a handle on this demographic problem, because so much money will pile up in a worker's health savings account while they're younger, right? Because I'm 45, yeah. For instance. This is about the age when things start breaking down. But for the last 20, 25 years, I've been employed. Haven't had anything catastrophic go wrong in any year, and money just piles up. So this little country, which, and I'll keep it a secret for now, which country it is, but they actually have so much money in their health savings accounts that they could run their entire healthcare system for about 4 years without a penny of funding from any other source, public or private. By comparison, I ran the numbers recently, the amount of money in our health savings accounts only amounts to about 14 days of U.S. healthcare spending. Mm-hmm. And so this other country, because they use health savings accounts and made sure they were filled properly, they're the only country that's actually gotten ahead of their demographic bubble. They're going to have enough money to pay for their elderly being sick in 20, 30 years. that they're not going to have to resort to, you know, unplugging granny at the hospital, which is happening a lot in single payer countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So don't keep us in suspense here. What's the country? Okay, so
the little country is Singapore. But if you mm-hmm. go there, and I've been a guest of the Ministry of Health and whatnot, and know a lot about their system, been there multiple times, actually even got injured once and was a patient, you know, nothing major. But yeah, they've got this amazing system, and they'll tell you that everything they implemented, they borrowed, and it was almost all borrowed from the United States. Like the guy, Dr. John Goodman, who invented health savings accounts, he's still alive. He's an American, right? Mm-hmm. We're the ones who invented high deductible health insurance. We're the ones who invented, you know, price tags, believe it or not. The guy who invented the price tag in world history, 1880, John Wanamaker, yeah, City of right. Philadelphia.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, oh, that's so
basically
funny.
They stole all our best ideas, and they've got this amazing healthcare system. Also the highest, best healthcare outcomes in the world, you mm-hmm. know, tied with the Japanese for life expectancy. You know, their infant mortality rate is like, I think, 1/3 of ours. I mean, mm-hmm. it's just an embarrassment how much money we're spending right now and how little we're getting for it, because we took away all the incentives for efficiency.
Yeah, that is pretty remarkable. You know, so many of the great ideas, that one, the Japanese program of continual constant improvement, you know, they stole all of it from, yeah, Kaizen. They stole it from IBM. You know, IBM yep. created that. And so many of the things, you know, the ideas just come and go, and sometimes never really seriously tried, which is really unfortunate. Hey, so drug companies, you know, Trump hates them. I hate them. You probably hate them. I mean, they seem like they're just have become criminal enterprises, and largely in part because of the government here, right?
Yes. Well, the big decision there, and people don't know the actual boogeyman, believe it or not, it's companies called PBMs, pharmacy benefit management yes. companies, that actually stand between mm-hmm. the pharmaceutical companies and then hospitals. Do you know about it?
Have oh, yeah, yeah. Like CVS owns one of them, Caremark, I think yes. it was, and there's one other one.
That's right.
And they figure out yeah. who gets paid what. And what drugstore gets paid how much. So I'd say CVS has a little bit of a conflict of interest there in that program. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so tell us.
Well, it goes, everything you said, completely true, but it goes one step beyond that. So in 1992, Congress removed the antitrust laws, the anti-monopoly laws, on PBMs, on these mm-hmm. pharmacy benefit management organizations.
Correct.
They also removed them on, what are they called? GPOs, group purchasing organizations, which do the same thing, but mm-hmm. For, you know, rubber gloves and hospital equipment. But let me concentrate on the PBMs, the pharmacy benefit management companies. Once those restrictions were lifted on antitrust, mm-hmm. basically these people could go around and they could do payola and stuff. So imagine there's a geographic area like Detroit. Say there's 20 hospitals there. It is perfectly legal since 1992 for the PBM, the pharmacy benefit management company, to go to each of the hospitals, go to each of their hospital administrators and bribe them and say, yeah. hey, I'm going to pay you $1 million per year. You're going to get a 1099 for this. This is all legal. I'm going to pay you $1 million a year, Mr. Hospital Administrator, and you're going to sign over an exclusive contract so that I'm the only one that can buy. I'm going to be a middleman. I'm going to be your agent. I'm the only one who can buy drugs for your hospital. I'm going to negotiate on your behalf with the pharmacy companies. Wow. And then imagine I go and I lock up every single hospital in the Detroit area, again, paying each of their hospital administrators $1 million a year to lock up that business. I then turn around and go to the pharmaceutical manufacturers and say, hey, look at this. I've locked up Detroit. I've got exclusives with every single hospital in Detroit. You can't sell them even a bottle of aspirin without my say-so. Oh, and guess mm-hmm. what I'm going to do now? Now that I've got a monopoly going here, I'm going to shake you down. I, mm-hmm. the pharmacy benefit management company, are going to shake you down, Mr. Pharmaceutical Company, and you're going to have to pay me what amounts to a giant kickback. And when you hear, Carrie, you know, companies, drug companies suddenly tripling the price of a drug, very often that's what's going on, is they're being shaken down by a PBM. And here's where we get back to no skin in the game. The pharmaceutical company is willing to go do this, right? They triple the price of their drugs. The PBM takes its skim in the middle, maybe half the money. Then but those high priced drugs now that are artificially high priced, they get passed through the hospital. The hospital doesn't really care, because then they just bill insurance, Medicaid, Medicare. And then the entire thing gets dumped onto the insurance company, who then just raises everyone's premiums. And no one notices that, because your employer is paying for the premium, not you as the individual.
Right.
And so the thing is just a ginormous scam. And so between the PBMs and the GPOs, the estimates are that they're shaking down the economy, with these legal monopolies that they're allowed to create since 1992. They're shaking down the economy for about $200 billion a year, which is about 1% of gross national product. So imagine that you artificially got to tax 1% of everything in America every year. That's essentially what they've been legally allowed to do. And it horrifies me.
So they're just rent seekers, basically, and adding no value to the chain whatsoever. But look, we've also got the FDA, which seems to have lost its way, and it exists to help large pharmaceutical companies acquire small upstarts, right? I mean, they're not really acting necessarily in the public's benefit, and the cost of getting a new drug approved is astronomical, which is why these small drug companies have to eventually be taken over or acquired by large drug companies.
Yes, yes. And, you as a libertarian are very familiar with the idea of regulatory capture, where an industry that's supposedly regulated by the government ends up, controlling all the bureaucrats who set the rules. And one of the most dramatically stupid things that we did in retrospect was the FDA, under pressure from the drug companies, changed its rules for certifying medicines. I think it was 1962. So before that time, the only thing a drug company had to do was prove safety. They didn't have to prove efficacy, that a drug actually worked, just safety.
Correct.
And so back then you had a model of early adopters, right? There'd be some previously existing drug that was the standard for, treating something like diabetes. Someone would come up with a new drug. They proved it was safe. It would go on the market. And then doctors would just start experimenting, right? They'd say to some patients, hey, let's try the new drug. And they'd see if it worked. And then they'd write up little medical articles, and they'd tell other doctors whether the new drug was better than the old drug. And there was this intense competition between the new drugs and the old drugs, which kept prices down. And new drugs would not take off and become popular unless they actually worked. So there you actually get your efficacy testing, right? It's sort of a distributed model. And that's how things worked before 1962. What that meant, though, in terms of, drug approvals, was that you only had the equivalent of current stage one drug approvals, right? We've now got stage one, stage two, stage three. The expensive parts of our system now, since we now require efficacy proof, are the stage two and stage three clinical trials, which, are these giant randomization things and, thousands of people, and it takes 10 years. And then they still don't get it right sometimes. It turns out in retrospect, drugs that have been approved to be quote unquote efficacious turn out to actually be really dangerous or completely ineffective. So we've switched to a system where there was easy access for an upstart entrepreneurial medical company with a new pharmaceutical or new drug to bring on the market, where they could test it very easily, because testing for safety is not hard. It runs very quickly and low cost. They could get it onto the market and then compete. Now, the only way to get anything onto the market and compete is to go through 10, 12 years of clinical trials, try and prove efficacy. And it also means it massively decreases the supply of new potential drugs, because in a typical year now, the FDA is only approving 15 or 20 drugs typically. Whereas if you had the old model, there'd be hundreds and hundreds of new drugs on the market every year, and which just demand and supply, that would push down prices.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt that would. And there's a lot of things we could do to bring down the cost, adopt the Singapore model, if you will, for everyone. But, the one thing that we hear in the healthcare debate is pre-existing conditions. You know, no insurance company wants to insure somebody with a prior medical condition that could lead to substantial payments in the future. What do you do with those people?
Okay, well, first of all, and I'm sure you've talked about this on your show before, the reason insurance doesn't work in that case is insurance is about future risks, about uncertainties, about, you know, say nautical insurance. 100 ships go out of port. Mm-hmm. How many of them will not come back next year? Maybe 4%. And then we base the insurance on 4% not coming back and the costs associated with that. Well, insurance doesn't work for pre-existing conditions. And the best example is a house fire. Imagine you're allowed to wait till your house burns down and then go to the insurance company and say, hey, I want to start paying $100 a month and you guys are going to rebuild my $200,000 house because it has a pre-existing condition. Well, that obviously would bankrupt insurance companies because if people knew that were a possibility, no one would pay their fire insurance premiums in advance. They just wait to see if their house burned down. And then if it did, they'd want to get cheap insurance. So what you need to do with pre-existing conditions is find some other mechanism as a society to pay for them. And, I know people who are born with serious disabilities. I've got a minor disability myself. It's pre-existing condition. It was there at birth. You could have a charity program. You could have some cost subsidy. There's got to be some other way to do it. But insurance will fail if you try and make it cover all the pre-existing conditions, just as pure insurance. There's got to be some other subsidy in there, which is why the Affordable Care Act, for instance, was giving subsidies to insurance companies for, here in California, we call it Covered California programs, right? Under the exchange programs, is I think the broader name. And yeah, you need some sort of subsidy program if you're going to do that, if people can't afford to pay for pre-existing conditions on their own. Which is one of the reasons we're in such a pickle here is we've tried to shoehorn everyone's medical conditions, including pre-existing conditions, into the insurance model, which wasn't designed for it. The insurance model was designed for future risks, uncertainties, things that haven't happened yet. And the math only works out if it's dealing with those things. So we need as a society to take it really seriously that for some things, insurance is not the best solution. And if we're a compassionate society and we care about people and we want to make sure that they, can cope with the pre-existing conditions and get the care they need, it's got to be done through some mechanism other than insurance.
Yeah. And what you say is true. What we call health insurance now really isn't health insurance. It's kind of this hybrid of, I call it prepaid medical service with the component of insurance that it'll pay, hopefully, for catastrophic or major medical procedures in the future. One final question, and then we'll kind of call it a day because we really, really spent a lot of time and I think worthwhile time with you, Sean. But the question, the concept of the nursing home, okay? How do we deal with that? Because ideally there shouldn't be nursing homes, but for whatever reasons, people can't live with their families or are too far gone to live with their families, or they don't want to, or Alzheimer's, whatever. What do we do about the nursing home industry?
Well, the first thing you need to look at is just say, who's making a lot of money here and why? And largely it's third-party billing, which explains why the costs of, nursing home care are so outrageously expensive, right? This is an industry where most of the people taking care of the elderly are getting paid $10 or $15 an hour. They're in buildings, which are just the equivalent of an average apartment building. And yet the costs are through the roof, and that's because there's third-party billing and no competition. So first of all, I want to just stress this idea that if there was transparency, price transparency, and some competition, the cost would probably fall at least by half, right? So that's one thing. The second, though, is that several other countries, including Singapore, by the way, have gone to models of trying to do aging in place, and they put a lot of resources into the community, including, for instance, classes for families with an elderly relative, like how do you take care of the elder relative? And if they get, occasionally cranky or maybe even violent at a low level, how do you deal with that if they've got dementia? And so what they try to do in these other countries, because it saves a pile of money, is And actually, a lot of elderly people massively prefer it is to stay in their own homes, their own apartments as they get older. You know, eventually everyone heads to their decline and has to walk out of life. But to take care of them in place at home. It's a model that I think we need to study much more intensively here.
And that has become a big trend over the past couple of decades is home health care and the visiting nurses, all of that. Definitely a plus. Also with nursing homes, and like I say, we're kind of pressed here, but just want to cover this. Nursing homes, we have an accreditation issue there too. Hey, if I want to open up my house and take care of sick and elderly people and have them pay me $2,000 a month, and I want to take care of 10 of them, guess what? If I do that and the government finds out about it, what's going to happen?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's yet another way of an industry protecting itself from competition and trying to keep its own profit margin massive. And so, yeah, obviously we need protections for people who are vulnerable. And there are some elderly who are extremely vulnerable. And, you know, to the point where in some really bad cases, family members are taking advantage of them financially and stuff. Oh, yeah. So obviously we need to protect the vulnerable, but we can do that without these massive unnecessary regulations you're pointing to, because they clearly aren't taking care of the vulnerable now, because we are currently, even though those regulations are in place, seeing a lot of elderly people exploited. And so we need a much better system both to protect the elderly and at the same time make sure there's enough competition in there that the prices are reasonable.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, hey, I agree with so much of what you said. You're preaching to the converted already, Sean, but there's nothing wrong with that, because a lot of the ideas that you discuss really aren't well known, like the Singapore experiment, if you will. So it's important that you know that. Hey, if people want to find out more about you, if they're in, you're in the 31st district in California, if I'm not mistaken, if they want to vote for you or get involved in your campaign, where should they go?
So you can go to the website, which is SeanFlynnForCongress.com. And the first name, SeanFlynn, SeanFlynnForCongress.com. And then all our social media, the Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, that's all under the username, the handle of SeanFlynnCA. CA is in California.
Okay, excellent. And we wish you the best of luck. The Congress can definitely use a guy like you who actually knows what you're talking about. It's it's a rare commodity in the People's Republic of California. And hey, as always, if you got any questions, if you want the medical hack list, like I say, this list has saved me tens of thousands of dollars over the past 4 years. I'm not exaggerating. Dr. Elena George, who's a big proponent of much of what Sean's talking about, is helped prepare this. She did prepare it. I just put the finishing touches on it, and it'll just save you a fortune. I mean, one example, a blood test in one of the big companies, the big labs, it was $500. At any lab test now, $100. So you need to get this. Just send me an email, kl@carrielutz.com. Don't forget our Twitter feeds @CarrieLutz, and our Facebook page is Financial Survival Network. Sean, thanks so much for coming on. We wish you the best of luck.
Okay, thank you, Carrie. True pleasure.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get 3 free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.